This is the 400th anniversary of the King James Version of the Bible, KJV. The King James Version of the Bible, it's known as the King James in the Americas, but it's known as the Authorized Version in the British Isles. They stand like the Tower of London as a monument at the heart of the English-speaking world. It is the best-selling book of all time. We know the Bible is the best-selling book of all time, but in fact the King James Version is the best-selling Bible of all the bestsellers. So it is the bestseller of the bestseller. The KJV is the Bible that endured, having the greatest formative influence on the development of the English language worldwide, which, remember when the English language started, so to speak, when the Tyndale version first proved a linguistic rallying point for the English language, less than 3 million people in the world spoke English. 3 million. Back when the Tyndale version came out in 1526. Today, over 2 billion people in the world communicate using English. So, who could have foreseen at the time that this backwater of Europe would have produced the language that became the most commonly used language in history? The KJV is actually one of the first British things to ever be made. It was made by the whole island shortly after inauguration of the United Kingdom of England and Scotland, when King James VI of Scotland became King James I of England. This is the Scottish flag, the St. Andrew's cross, the white X on blue. The English flag is the red cross on white, or St. George's flag. It was the St. George's cross and the St. Andrew's cross joined together made the Union Jack, or the United Kingdom flag, what we know as the Union Jack. And this was the first time you had Great Britain, because you now had the King of Scotland and the King of England joined in one person. And so you had the United Kingdom of Scotland and Ireland. That was 1603. For the 400th anniversary of the Authorized Version, Great Britain is hosting at least 70 different events, as far as we can tell, including a continuous reading of the whole Bible at Blackburn Cathedral. And we once did this when I came out of the army back in 1981. Went to Hillbrow, and at the high point in Hillbrow, where there are 25 shops and doors never closed, and people just coming in and out the whole time, Hillbrow's a buzz. We had a 24-hour reading of the Bible over a long weekend, and it took, by the way, 72 hours to read through the whole Bible aloud, with the interruptions that come from. It wasn't totally free-flowing. You could probably do it in less, but we did it in 72 hours. Including continuous reading the Bible, symposiums are at Cambridge University in Aberdeen. St. George's College in Cambridge is hosting a special expedition. And Britain's issued a special £2 coin. Here it is. With, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Straight from the KJV, and that's on the coin. The British Royal Mail is issuing a special commemorative postage stamp. Even the British Broadcasting Corporation, which is never a friend of the gospel, but they are going to show an hour-long documentary, but I wouldn't hold my breath over whether it'll be positive. Here you can see this magnificent new £2 coin that's being circulated. Isn't that just tremendous? King James Bible on top, 1611 to 2011, with Her Majesty the Queen on the other side. That's a wonderful public national acknowledgement of the importance of the KJV. Everyone's going to handle a £2 coin next year. The Duke of Edinburgh launched the official celebrations in the banqueting house at Whitehall. Innumerable websites have been set up to celebrate the Authorized Version. There is no doubt that the KJV Bible is the most beloved and the most respected Bible in all of history. It has an ageless magnificence, a beauty of phrase, and a poetical arrangement which is absolutely unique. It is not possible to comprehend the history of the English-speaking peoples without understanding the great KJV translation. Schools, wherever they teach English, whether it be India or Zambia or New Zealand or South Africa or United States or Canada, they should be studying the Bible, and especially the King James Version, especially at this year, but on any given year, how can any education be of any worth if it doesn't look at the greatest example of literature and the most formative and important book in history? The KJV Bible has most certainly been far more influential than even Shakespeare in the development and the spread of English worldwide. In fact, William Shakespeare's writings are saturated with scripture, and many of the most memorable phrases of Shakespeare come from the Bible anyway. The KJV is the most preeminent Bible translation of all time. Without any doubt, this is the greatest example of English literature ever produced. And in any English literature class, in any university, if you were to ask them, what is the greatest example of English literature, could they come up with something better? I think the closest they could would be William Shakespeare. But even then, Shakespeare completely based all of his thought and communications on the Bible. No book ever had such a great impact on the development of a language and culture as the KJV has had. Nor can any other Bible translation claim to have inspired so many revivals and the launching of so many missionary movements as the KJV. That's just a staggering thought. Just think of all the great missionary movements, all the great revivals, the great evangelical awakenings. This was the Bible translation that God used to inspire and mobilize those great movements. The KJV attracts superlatives. It is the most important book in the English language, the most important book in the English religion, and the most important book in the English culture. It's the most celebrated book throughout the English-speaking world. It is the most enduring embodiment of Scripture in the English language, and it is the gold standard by which all other Bible translations are evaluated. All other versions still exist, as it were, in its shadow. It has shaped, formed, and molded the language in which others must speak. So even when others speak, even when they're trying to criticize the KJV, they're using so much of the language terms that were developed by it. The KJV is the most influential version of the most influential book in the world in what became the most influential language in the world. When an African prince approached Queen Victoria at the height of her power, when Britain ruled a staggering amount of the world, over one-fifth of the world's land surface, and asked, what is the secret of Britain's greatness? She presented him with a Bible and said, this is the secret and the foundation of all our greatness, the Word of God. And it was a copy of the KJV Bible. By the way, the picture on the right I took at Lindisfarne, Holy Island, in England, where you can see the KJV Bible in the foreground before the altar. And this is where the Vikings made themselves first known, with the raid on Lindisfarne Monastery. English linguist Professor David Crystal of Oxford University, following a very strict methodology, came up with at least 256 unique idioms from the authorized version which have entered into English language. And he didn't take a lot of things that others would put in, because he used the strictest methodology that it had to be absolutely unique and there was no other source where it could have come from, even before. And absolutely unique KJV terms include feet of clay, land of milk and honey, whited sepulchres, girded loins, salted, and over 250 more. Most of the Gideon Bibles in hotel rooms around the world are King James Version. Oxford University Press alone sells over 250,000 copies of the KJV every year, which it describes as the most widely owned and the most widely used translation of the Bible. And throughout all of history, that would be true. Pre-Reformation Bibles were mostly in Latin. This precluded ordinary people from hearing or even understanding the scriptures. Now, there were some exceptions. King Alfred the Great in the 9th century did translate the Gospels into Anglo-Saxon. And the Lindisfarne Gospels included Anglo-Saxon interlinear script written between the lines of the Latin text. And that was wonderful. This is Lindisfarne, Ireland. But what one needs to remember is all of these were handwritten copies of the Bible, and therefore there were very few of them. Professor John Wycliffe of Oxford University translated the Latin Vulgate into English. He didn't have access to the Greek. He didn't have access to the Hebrew. But he translates straight from the Latin, which itself was a translation. So, and Latin's a very dead, wooden language. It's noun-rich, not verb-rich. Anglo-Saxon is verb-rich. And so, in fact, if you read Wycliffe's translation, a lot of it seems wooden and dull because it's translating from Latin, which is even duller. And therefore, a lot of the original Bible had been lost until they went back to translating straight from the Greek and Hebrew. And they found English was able to take the Greek and Hebrew concepts much, much more effectively than Latin could, because Latin is a very flat language when it comes to verbs But those were only handwritten copies that were published. In this was in 1380, in the Old Testament in 1382. So these handwritten copies of the Bible, which were, of course, very few in number. Today, I think there's less than 50 copies of the Wycliffe Bible in existence. As these were only handwritten, very few in number, they were therefore inaccessible to the common man. You had to be spectacularly wealthy to have one of these Bibles. It would cost 1 to 2 years' wages to get a copy of a Wycliffe Bible at those days. Today, these Bibles cost millions. The invention of the printing press by Johannes Gutenberg in the 1400s and the printing of the first book, obviously a Bible, in Latin on a mechanical, movable type printing press made possible a revival of learning and a revival of education and a circulation of literature on a scale never before seen in all of human history. The invention of the printing press laid the groundwork for the Reformation in the 16th century. The printing press was often referred to as the reformer's friend, the tyrant's foe. Tyrants hated the printing press, much like I think they hate the internet today, because they can't control it. And so the printing press laid the framework not only for the Reformation, but for the scientific revolution, and for the industrial revolution, and for the information age, and so much that has grown out of that. Here you have a copy of a Wycliffe Bible, and this is a copy of what you see in the hallway at in our Reformation wall at the end, where we've got a copy of a page from the first Bible ever printed, which is the Gutenberg Bible in Latin. And here you have that on display at the Creation Museum, top left, and an actual copy in the foreground, and one page showing the beautiful script, but of course it's all in Latin, but it was printed. A Gutenberg Bible today, one Gutenberg Bible was sold recently for $4.5 million. There is no Bible in the world that can compare. There's no book in the world that can compare with a Bible in value. Try selling a copy of Harry Potter for the same price. In 1516, the eminent scholar Erasmus published the Greek New Testament, what has become known as the Textus Receptus, or the Received Text. This Greek New Testament, made available by Erasmus, was used by William Tyndale, depicted on the left, translating on the run, to translate the New Testament into English. And this was essential. It was the same New Testament in Greek that was carried around by Ulrich Zwingli, and Ulrich Zwingli was able to memorize the whole New Testament in Greek, and it brought him to Christ, especially the epistles of St. Paul. So Erasmus's translation of the New Testament, or making available, collecting all the manuscripts together, producing one coherent, edited whole, available in a printed format. This was used by Luther, this was used by Tyndale, this was used by Zwingli. It made a major impact in making the Bible more accessible to people who were learned, who then translated into the local languages. The first English New Testament to be translated from the original languages, Hebrew and Greek, and printed, the first English Bible to be printed, was William Tyndale's work, which was first smuggled into England in 1526. It was illegal to translate the Bible into English in England. He had to do it in Germany. It had to be smuggled from Antwerp in bales of cotton into England, and they were intercepted and destroyed. 1536, the Bible translator William Tyndale was burned at the stake at Vilvoorde for the crime of translating the Bible into English. And this is the monument at Vilvoorde where Tyndale was martyred. And the wording on the plaque: William Tyndale, who suffered martyrdom under Spanish rule October 6, 1536, was strangled and burned at Vilvoorde. Among his last words were these: Lord, open the eyes of the King of England. This prayer was answered within a year by the issue under royal authority of the whole Bible in English. William Tyndale's motto was, if God spare my life ere many years, I will cause a boy who drives the plough to know more of the scriptures than you do. He said this to a priest. Well, his co-worker and friend Coverdale was the one who managed to get the whole Bible published. And it was his Bible that became the official Great Bible of 1539, which was authorized by King Henry VIII, for reading aloud in the churches. The Great Bible was mostly the work of William Tyndale, about 90%, because Tyndale did not live long enough to finish the whole Bible. He got the New Testament published, he's working through the Old Testament, Coverdale finished it all, put it into one whole, and he got this out. And by God's grace, because of Archbishop Thomas Cranmer and the Chancellor, Thomas Cromwell, they managed to actually get this authorized by the King himself. And this is the Coverdale Bible, the cover page, and you can see the kind of text being used. Not as easy to read. You'll see how different it is from the King James Version's text and the Geneva Bible's text, which is much easier to read. But this was the first authorized Bible, so to speak, in English, because the King appointed it to be read in the whole church. And that's extraordinary, because that's the same King who had ordered Tyndale an outlaw and to be pursued to death for his work of translating the Bible into English. But within a year, he was authorizing that which he had banned, which is a remarkable turn of events. And this, notice how, still at this stage, they will be using the wife where we'd use an I. Notice how they still use the long S, where we would have S, they would have what we think we see as an F, but that was what they called the long S, very much like the German double S and so on. And this is the Great Bible of 1539. Coverdale's work, just slightly reshaped for the purposes of public reading for the churches. The Great Bible. The accession to the throne of England of the young Edward VI, a Protestant, gave unprecedented religious freedom and impetus to the translation of the Bible into English. Now it could go forward, because Henry VIII was never a Protestant. He was a Catholic who split with Rome, but he was still doctrinally a Catholic. But his son, Edward VI, he was a dedicated Protestant. And although he was only young, he was 9 years old when he became king, 15 years old when he died. But in the 6 years of him being king, there was unprecedented growth for the gospel in England. But the untimely death of King Edward, almost certainly due to poisoning by Jesuits, and the accession to the throne of Bloody Mary led to a reign of terror from 1553 to 1558, in which hundreds of men, women, and children were burned to death or beheaded, including the young and courageous Lady Jane Grey, who should have been queen. She was only queen for 9 days, and deposed by Bloody Mary and beheaded by her for refusing to renounce her Protestant faith. Many martyrs burned at the stake, including some of the most prominent Protestant Bible translators. John Rogers, for example, was the first to be burned at the stake, a Bible translator. Teachers, preachers, theologians, some of the greatest names in the church in England, such as Nicholas Ridley and Hugh Latimer, they were burned at the stake in Oxford. And even the Archbishop of Canterbury, the first Protestant Archbishop of Canterbury ever, Thomas Cranmer, the author of the Book of Common Prayer, burned to death in Oxford. This is the seal of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer. And the cross marks the place where these bishops were burned. And this monument was set up in the days of Queen Victoria to the Oxford martyrs. Fox's Book of Martyrs presents a more meaningful monument worldwide. That this is one of the best sellers in all of English history, just behind Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan. And in here, many of the testimonies of these courageous martyrs are recorded. Well, the persecution by Bloody Mary led many church leaders to flee to Switzerland for sanctuary. And you see on the left, Calvin's Auditoire. On the right, this is Saint-Pierre, the cathedral of John Calvin, where John Calvin and William Farrell preached. And on the left, that's the chapel where the English refugees fleeing from Mary were given a chapel in what's called Calvin's Auditoire. Calvin did his lectures to students there during the week, and on Sunday John Knox preached to the English refugees, and of course other preachers did too, in English. So that was the English chapel. That's in Geneva, right next to, if you look at Calvin's cathedral here, it's immediately to the right, the auditoire, which is where we held our Calvin 500 daytime lectures. Every evening we had services in the main cathedral, but during day our presentations were all in the auditoire, which was the original academy where the theologians were trained by Calvin before they built the academy. So it's for this reason, this concentration of English refugees fleeing persecution in Geneva, that the next Bible translation to English was known as the Geneva Bible, because it was English refugees in Geneva who translated it, and that was published in 1560. The New Testament was published in 1557, and the complete Bible in English, the Geneva Bible, was completed in 1560, the very year that John Knox was sweeping through Scotland and transforming Scotland into the Reformation. The Geneva Bible was a good scholarly work using original Roman type, smaller fonts, the familiar verse formats of today's Bibles, and highlighting particular words to show where they'd been added to the original for emphasis. So you can see, here's the text, but on the side is all these margin notes. And all the way through, you get these margin notes. And here you can see how there's introductions to each of the books in the Bible. And again, the different notes are inside. And they were using the verse numbers. The first Bible to actually use the verse numbers was the Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible was in general use for over 60 years, and it was the Bible quoted by playwrights such as William Shakespeare. The Geneva Bible was the first to bring out a pocket edition, so-called. Not what you and I would call a pocket edition. It was still bigger than this, but that was a lot smaller than the Bibles that had been available before that. Well, maybe they had very big pockets. Maybe you think of the side saddles of a horse. But this so-called pocket book of the Bible was, of course, much easier to carry around than the traditional large formats, which are colossal, huge, weightlifting material, which were normally just on the church's lecterns. The Geneva Bible was the Bible of the Puritans. It was one of the most historically significant translations of the Bible in the English language, and the Geneva Bible preceded the KJV by 51 years. It was the primary Bible of the 16th century Protestant movement, and it was the Bible used by William Shakespeare, by Oliver Cromwell, by John Milton, by John Knox, by John Bunyan in Pilgrim's Progress. That is the if you try to compare Pilgrim's Progress original with your Bible and you think, it sounds a bit different, that's because it was an earlier translation. It's older English as well. The Geneva Bible was the primary Bible of the Pilgrims who founded America. This most famous oil painting, which you can get in the rotunda in the American Congress, you see they've got the Holy Bible there. Many people think that's the King James Version, but no, it's the Geneva Bible. There are three copies of the Geneva Bible on the Mayflower. That was the first English Bible to go into North America with the Pilgrims. The Geneva Bible was also the primary Bible used by Ironside soldiers of Oliver Cromwell during the English Civil War, and you'll see why in a moment. The Geneva Bible was the first mechanically printed, mass-produced Bible made generally available direct to the public with a variety of scriptural study guides and aids, including woodcut illustrations, maps, charts, indexes. And interestingly enough, many of the woodcuts used in the Geneva Bible are the same woodcuts used in Luther's Bible. They must have had the same printer, because you can compare exactly the same woodcuts. In order to get pictures in a Bible or maps, you would need a woodcut, because remember, this is before lithograph plate. They would have been putting all the text into the printing trays. But how do you get the pictures? You leave space. Later, you've got to take this carved into a flat piece of wood, the picture, like a stamp pad. You stamp it into the ink, and you've got to hopefully not get it skew. You see, they may differ. If you look at them, the woodcuts are never exactly the same. Unless people are very meticulous. But those woodcuts had to effectively be stamped after the printing process. It's quite a difficult thing. Later they managed to incorporate the woodcuts into the actual mechanical process along with the printing trays for the text. That's a good question. Did they carve the text? I would say that the text was printed first, and then the woodcuts had to overlay it. The text would have been printed first, unless they were carving the text into the woodcut, which would be very hard. Very hard. So this is the first study Bible, the Geneva Bible. Therefore, the Geneva Bible is the world's first study Bible, and over 150 editions of the Geneva Bible were printed between 1560 and 1644. You all know what happened in 1644. That's smack in the middle of the English Civil War, and when the Westminster Confession was being composed by the representatives of especially the Presbyterian churches. Interestingly, the very first Bible to be printed in Scotland was a Geneva Bible in 1579. And a law was passed in Scotland that very year requiring every household to purchase a copy. You had to have a copy of the Geneva Bible, according to the law in Scotland. And the study notes were very Calvinist and very Puritan in character. And they were particularly objected to by the bishops and the royalty for being seditious, rebellious. Because remember, Geneva was a republic. England was a monarchy. And so the Geneva Bible had a lot of republican sentiment in the sense of it was very anti-monarchical. There was a lot of taking where the Bible says king and the Geneva Bible translates tyrant. And there was the notes in the margin really emphasized resistance to authority and wiping out evil kings like Jehu, being sent by God to go and wipe out the evil king Ahab and so on. So, emphasizing the wickedness of Jezebel, and you could just draw the dotted lines to Queen Mary and so on. So the study notes of the Geneva Bible, while absolutely outstanding from the point of view of a Puritan, would have been regarded with horror by a monarchist in Great Britain. The Geneva Study Bible was by a whole lot of refugees. John Knox was for a time on the committee, but he didn't stay for the whole time. So John Knox would have been the most prominent individual involved in the translation process. John Calvin definitely had input, and so did Theodore Beza, his number one theologian, because Theodore Beza is the one who took over the academy upon the death of John Calvin. So Beza and Calvin were heavily involved in helping advise and guide every stage of the Geneva Bible translation. It was very much under their auspices that these refugees were doing this work. But Knox had a strong input, and some of the study notes have got John Knox's fingerprints on it, particularly his hostility to the monarchy. Well, that wasn't acceptable to the average monarchist in Britain, so they came up with a Bishop's Bible. And the official Bishop's Bible was published in England in 1568, obviously in direct reaction to the Geneva Bible. And the Church of England issued the Bishop's Bible. Essentially, it was a revision of the Great Bible, which was mostly based on William Tyndale's work. But the thing that's so striking about the Bishop's Bible is it offended nobody and it didn't inspire too many. It was very flat, very wooden, a very cumbersome translation. The Bishop's Bible remained in use in the churches until the King James Bible was published in 1611, in which time it replaced all the Bishop's Bibles and they went into history. And have barely been heard of since, because nobody was still wanting to get a Bishop's Bible once you brought out the King James, because it was just so superior. Now, when Queen Elizabeth I died on the 24th of March 1603, she'd never married, she was childless. The crown of England passed to her cousin, King James I, who had already been King of Scotland for 37 years. Now, King James I was the son of Mary, Queen of Scots. And Mary, Queen of Scots, was about as wicked and evil a woman as you could imagine. And she murdered her own husband, who would have been King James's father. But nevertheless, he resented the Presbyterians who raised him and who had overthrown his mother. But no one would have known that till he became King of England as well, because they all thought he was very pro-Presbyterian. He had to be, because they were the power in Scotland. Only when he moved to England did his real colours come out. And so on his way to England, this is part of his royal procession, where he took a long time coming down from Scotland from Edinburgh all the way down to London. He was intercepted during this royal procession to his coronation in London And a delegation of Puritans presented James with a millenary petition, which had over 1,000 signatures, hence it was called the millenary petition. And those 1,000 clergy represented 10% of the clergy of England, and they were all Puritans. And this petition was the catalyst for the Hampton Court Conference, out of which the King James Version developed. So, the road to Hampton Court. To understand what happened to Hampton Court, you've got to know the players involved in this. First of all, there were the Puritans. It's easy to remember because it all starts with P. The Puritans were loyal to the crown, they were royalists, but they were Calvinists who insisted that England's Reformation under Edward VI and under Queen Elizabeth I had not gone far enough. They wanted more. But then there were the Presbyterians, mostly Scottish, who wanted to do away with the hierarchical structures of powerful bishops, and they promoted instead a model of church administration under elders, or presbyters. So the Puritans were normally Church of England, like Oliver Cromwell, but they were loyal to the crown, but they were Calvinists. The Presbyterians were Calvinists, but they wanted to get rid of all bishops. Then you had the Pilgrims, and the Pilgrims were nonconformists or separatists who just wanted the state out of all church affairs together. The Puritans didn't mind the state involved. They didn't mind a state church. They just wanted a purified state church. The Presbyterians wanted a Presbyterian state church. The Pilgrims just wanted congregational self-government, and if we can't get this, let's just leave and go to America anyway. So they were separatists. They want the state out of church affairs altogether, and many of them would immigrate to North America, and that's why North America's first, the first item on the Bill of Rights is that the state should make no law establishing or preventing the free exercise of any religion. So you can see the Pilgrims' fingerprints over there. That's England is a monarchy, America is a republic, the Pilgrims were separatists, and you can see the difference between the English church and the American church as a result. And the Pilgrims settled in America and put their stamp very heavily on the early time in America, and here you've got the first Thanksgiving meal being celebrated in New England. Then you had Parliament. Parliament was eager to expand its power because Britain was an autocratic state, and the Parliament had a shaky bit of influence, but not enough. The king could still override Parliament easily. And remember, the Puritans retained significant influence, and they had a heavy representation in Parliament. So the Puritans controlled a lot of Parliament, and their agenda was make the king constitutional monarch, where he's under the law, not above it. Then you had the Papists, or the Roman Catholics, who wanted the English church to be returned to the authority of the Pope, and Guy Fawkes, depicted here, was one of these Roman Catholic soldiers who was involved in the gunpowder plot where he wanted to blow up Parliament. He smuggled barrels of gunpowder into the basement of Palace of Westminster and was going to blow up the king and all of the Parliament at its opening. And because the Catholics were excluded from the translation process, they attempted to assassinate King James and they wanted to blow up Parliament, which they attempted on the 5th of November. And this gunpowder plot is remembered every year in the Guy Fawkes fireworks in Great Britain, and that's burning Guy Fawkes and effigy and the fireworks, it's all part of that. And I think few people are thinking about the King James Version of the Bible, the Papist plot to blow up Parliament, or any of the reasons for this, but that's how it came about. Another one of these idiosyncrasies of the English-speaking world. Then you had the privileged bishops, who had exceptional power and wealth, and they had seats in the House of Lords. They were determined to resist the Puritans, the Presbyterians, and the Pilgrims. They would be Church of England, the bishops. And every bishop in England has a seat in the House of Lords, de facto. Which is actually very biblical, because if you think of how the Sanhedrin was set up, you were meant to have representative bishops from each of the 12 tribes and lawyers from each of the 12 tribes. So plainly Britain's House of Lords is set up on the same concept, that the higher court, the higher house represents both ecclesiastical and the civil leaders. So, the Hampton Court Conference. James took the Puritan petition seriously enough to call for a conference which took place in October 1603 at Hampton Court, which was originally built by Cardinal Wolsey. It was a 1,000-roomed estate just outside of London, absolutely magnificent, palatial, incredible place, And only four moderate representatives of the Puritan cause were invited to participate in the conference before the king at Hampton Court. Here you can get a good view of Hampton Court, just the incredible gardens and this massive palace. And notice how the church is absolutely central in it, as in any decent palace in those days. The nine bishops and deans and the Privy Council were clearly prejudiced against the Puritans, who they saw as subversive. King James delivered the opening address, making clear that the doctrine and the policy of the state church was not up for evaluation or reconsideration. He made no effort to hide his frustration with the Presbyterian model that he had endured in Scotland. And those who had hoped that he would be sympathetic to the Presbyterian or Puritan cause had obviously misunderstood his intransigence on this issue. However, the Puritans were not allowed to attend the first day of the conference, and so they didn't hear the speech, and they weren't aware of his plain prejudice against the Puritan and Presbyterian position. So when on the second day the four Puritans were allowed to join the meeting, they started on the wrong foot by suggesting, let us broaden the decision-making base. Why shouldn't the bishops govern jointly with the presbytery of their brethren, the pastors and ministers of the church? And the king exploded in reply. That's how far they got. Two sentences. If you aim at a Scots presbytery, it agrees as well with the monarchy as God and the devil. The word presbytery was apparently like a red flag to a bull, and King James uttered his final word on the matter. No bishop, no king. If you don't have a hierarchical system of church government, then why would you have a monarchical system of political government? He had a point. The king warned the Puritans, if this be all your party has to say, I will make them conform themselves, or else I will harry them out of the kingdom, or else I will do worse. So this was the beginning of the conference, and it hasn't started well. And it's at this point that Dr. John Reynolds, the president of Corpus Christi College at Oxford, and a leader of the Puritan side in the Church of England, and on the side of the, he is one of the greatest scholars of his day, he proposed a new translation of the Bible into English. This was not part of the millenary petition, by the way. This is something he just did on a spur of the moment, because the king had apparently just wiped the table. He's not interested in anything on the millenary petition, and they've just started the conference. Where's it going to go? It's dead in the water. And he saves the day by saying, we need a new translation of the Bible. And surprisingly to many, King James responded very warmly to the suggestion, because he despised the then popular Geneva Bible, and he knew the Bishop's Bible wasn't terribly popular either, and people were still reading the Geneva Bible. They needed something else. The king was troubled by the often revolutionary margin notes of the Geneva Bible, which spoke extensively against corrupt and immoral kings. King James ordered that a single translation that the whole nation could rely on to be read in the whole church should be produced by 50 of the nation's finest language scholars, and he approved rules for the final checking of the results, including no margin notes at all, but only for the explanation of Hebrew or Greek words had to be added later. He said, but we need some explanation of some words, because some is not obvious, and then that was allowed. And to draw attention to parallel passages was suggested, and that was later allowed, but his first word was no margin notes. Six panels of translators had their work divided up between them. The Old Testament was entrusted to three panels, New Testament to two panels, the Apocrypha to one panel. Two of the panels met at Oxford University, two at Cambridge, and two at Westminster. The most learned men in the universities of Oxford and Cambridge were to take the lead in the work, which was to be reviewed by the bishops, represented then to the Privy Council, lastly ratified by royal authority. So they had to go through some pretty stringent means. Each section would have six people in it, and then they'd each translate the passage on their own, then they'd come together and they'd discuss this out, and they'd hammer out this chapter, and then they'd come to agreement. But once they'd agreed, it went to the higher panel, which reviewed it before it could go to the bishops, before it could go to the Privy Council, before it could end up to the king. The KJV must be the only work of literary genius to have ever been produced by a committee. And these committees are notoriously uninspiring in their wording of what they produce. But the group of great scholars that they chose had unparalleled qualifications. I don't think we'll ever in history have a translation team like this again, because listen to their qualifications. Most of them had spent most of their lives in the pursuit of God and of knowledge. One translator, Dr. Lancelot Andrews, mastered at least 15 languages, and by the time he was 6 years old, he'd read the entire Bible in Hebrew, including New Testament, because he had the he had a Hebrew translation of the New Testament too. Some of the translators had written foreign language dictionaries and lexicons. They commonly debated in Greek. They translated and edited great works. They had written their own works. Not only did the translators know the biblical languages of Hebrew and Aramaic and Greek, but many of them also knew related languages that enabled them to study other documents and translations by the church fathers in Persian, Coptic, Syrian, Chaldean, Latin, French, Italian, German, and Dutch. Of course, German was very important, studying Luther's translation, which had a very strong impact on how they interpreted quite a lot of key parts in Greek. Some of the translators prayed 5 hours a day. Where are you going to find Bible translators like this today? The translators were world-class scholars, Christians who lived holy lives. They were prominent as deans, professors, presidents of major colleges at Oxford and Cambridge universities. These were some of the greatest men of some of the greatest universities in history, who had excelled and who were leaders in their fields. And how do you get 50 men like that together for any project? And after the final draft was completed by the 54 scholars, a concluding committee of 12 of them reviewed what the lower committee had prepared, and then Bishop Thomas Bilson and Dr. Miles Smith added the finishing touches and made it cohesive. By 1609, the whole revision was ready, and Miles Smith, the canon of Hereford, later to become Bishop of Gloucester, and Thomas Bilson, the Bishop of Winchester, they saw it through to the printing press, and Miles Smith composed the preface, which is the translators to the readers, which you can read in most KJVs today. Although King James contributed no money to its production, and although no record of an official authorization of the finished product survives, if such was ever issued, we don't know if it was authorized. Maybe it was, but if there was such document, it could have got burned up in the fire of London in 1666. The point is, it's been known as the King James Version. Certainly it was dedicated to the king, which is a very wise thing to do when the king could have your head. It was certainly not the only authorized version. It wasn't the first authorized version. The Coverdale Bible, or the Great Bible, was the first truly authorized Bible under King Henry VIII in English. That was the 1539. Also, the Bishop's Bible was authorized by Queen Elizabeth I in 1568. Not everyone supported the King James Bible at its first publication. It may surprise us to know. Distinguished scholar Dr. Hugh Boughton, for example, declared that it bred in me a sadness that will grieve me while I breathe. Tell His Majesty that I had rather be rent in pieces with wild horses than any such translation by my consent should be urged upon the churches. And the new edition crosseth me, upsets me. I require it to be burned. So that's one top theologian's response. John Lightfoot objected to the Apocrypha being placed in the Bible, and that's one thing that has, of course, concerned many of us, that they could have put something other than the Bible in the Bible. But it was of immense historical interest, but to print it separately, but not to put it into the Bible. The Apocrypha is good reading, but it's not inspired. It's not God's word. So, not in modern ones. But in the first editions of the KJV, they always had the Apocrypha in it. The KJV went through 15 printings in the first 3 years, with the translation committees being forced to make some minor revisions. The KJV most people use today is actually the result of a final revision brought about in 1769. So when people say the 1611, yes, it is the 1611, but there's been some changes. Good ones, important ones, just correcting errors or things where they discovered later this was not the best wording in translation. So it's been refined, so the 1769 is even better than the 1611. When I was invited to minister at Martyrs Memorial Church in Belfast by Dr. Ian Paisley, I noticed right smack in the middle of the church is the KJV Bible, prominently on display, a big prominent one. And this is the gold standard many churches by which all sermons have to be done. There's many a church I go to where they require that I only read from and quote from the KJV. The KJV is an incredible achievement, actually. It's an enduring work which has had an enormous impact on hundreds of millions of lives, and on the English language itself, and on the English culture, and on world history. It is the most important translation of the most important book in what has become the most important language in the world. It is a treasure. In the preface to the 1611 edition, the translators of the Authorized Version stated that it was not their purpose to make a new translation, but to make good ones better. And that's what they did. They took Tyndale's, they took Coverdale's, they took the Geneva Bible, they looked at all the others, they went to the original Greek, and they made out of good ones, not just the better, but in many cases we'd say the best. And so, this year, there are new editions of the KJV coming out. If people thought that the language is antiquated and the Bible has passed its prime, you'd be amazed to know how many are being sold these days. In the preface to the translators, or the translators to the readers, they recorded their debt to the earlier works of William Tyndale and other reformers and Bible translators, and the New King James Version seeks to be faithful to the original text and to retain the King James Version's style and idiom while keeping abreast of changes in English speech, such as conversation today means your language, what you say. Conversation in those days meant your lifestyle. And there's other things like that. Here you can see how the Bibles have developed. You can see the original manuscripts, early copies, ancient versions, the Latin Vulgate, which was used straight by the Catholics for the Douay version of 1610. Then they had to run up the white flag because there were too many English Bibles out there. You can see here, Wycliffe used the Masoretic text and the Vulgate. Tyndale had access to ancient copies, and he looked at the others. Coverdale based almost entirely on Tyndale and Matthews as well. The Great Bible is based on Tyndale. Geneva Bible, the same. The King James is based on all of these. But today, we have some translations like the New King James, 1982, that can go back to some even older and earlier texts and just refine some of those little points where the translators in the 1500s would not have had access to some of those documents which today have come out, like Dead Sea Scrolls and so on. So today we have the New King James Version in many different ways, including in DVD and CD, and very nice, easy, compact styles, study Bibles. In this 400th anniversary of the publication of the King James Version, why don't you undertake to read through the whole Bible? And if you read just four chapters a day, it'll get you through the whole Bible in a calendar year, there being 1,187 chapters in the Bible. Four chapters a day get you through in a calendar year.